Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hej alla poddkompisar. Alltså idag är det spännande för att det finns en fantastisk kvinna som jag träffar just nu för första gången. Hon är bästsäljande författare. Catherine May heter hon och är i Sverige på författarbesök. Ni har säkert sett boken, om ni inte har hunnit läsa den. På svenska heter den Övervintring eller Wintering in English. Så den här intervjun kommer bli på engelska, så att då får ni ha lite överseende med att jag gör så gott jag kan. Och jag hoppas att ni kommer uppskatta det här. Jag känner mig väldigt spänd, glad och förväntansfull. So, welcome Catherine May.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah. Best-selling author.
Apparently so, yeah.
Apparently so. How does that feel?
Do you know what? It's been a very strange time to become a best-selling author because I've had books out before and, you know, they've done fine, but no big deal. But I hit the New York Times bestseller list when we were deep in lockdown, and so I've still not managed to get to America since. So it felt really disembodied and just kind of not real, really. Like, it was a sort of story. And in fact, for the first week, I was convinced that all the other New York Times bestselling authors were like in a little gang laughing at me, you know. Like, who the hell's she? And when it stayed in for the second week, I had to ring my publisher and say, I'm so relieved because I don't feel like the kind of out girl from the group anymore.
Yeah, I'm in there.
But I only hit the UK bestseller list last week after 2 years on the market. So it's been a long journey there, strangely.
That's kind of interesting as well. And I'm going to tell my pod buddies, as pod I call buddies. Them in Sweden. I don't know if you know this, but it's kind of not a really easy way as being an English author, as yeah. you are, yeah. being published and also hitting the lists yeah. in America. That's a quite big thing. So it's you you deal. Should be really impressed by this woman. I am.
I'm impressed, aren't
I? I have, of course, Googled you, and I've been looking at YouTube's clips and when you're talking about the book and everything. But for me, I think you as a person also is really interesting. Mm. The first thing when I'm searching, it says like when I was 17, I had a depression.
Yeah.
It always kind of starts with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm like, yeah. What happened before is one question I have. Yeah. You know, how yeah. was your upbringing?
I had a really pleasant upbringing in lots of ways. I was brought up by a single mother. My parents divorced when I was 3. So I didn't have much of a relationship with my dad, but I didn't carry that kind of upset that some people carry about their parents separating. I just never really knew them together. But I, like many women of my age are discovering now, I grew up as an undiagnosed autistic girl.
Yeah.
And so life was really difficult for me, even though I had a really loving, kind of supportive family who took great care of me, actually. I think people assume that it must have been very traumatic, but actually the trauma came from not knowing what I was rather than who I was. That was the hard bit.
Yeah. And what do you think caused this depression when you were 17? Do you have an answer for that or a truth for you?
Well, I suppose the kind of immediate cause it was that it happened after my grandma died. I was very close to my grandma. We lived in her house for a lot of the time because we couldn't afford our own place. And even after we'd moved out, we spent a lot of time together, me and my gran. We were very close. And that triggered it. But also, I was already depressed after years of feeling like an outcast, really. You know, to grow up autistic is to feel fundamentally different from the other children around you. And to know that your emotions are operating in a very different way, that your responses to the world are different. And I had no opportunity to make an account of that. I couldn't name it, but I knew that there was something, and my mother knew that there was something too. And so I think, I mean, I've met loads of autistic women of my age since then, and we all went through the same thing. And 17, interestingly, is the age that everything seems to collapse for most of us. It's just this moment when you're approaching adulthood and a lot of different pressures kind of round up on you. And I didn't like myself enough to continue. It was just, you know, it's the age when lots of people develop addictions, which I know you know loads
about. Yeah, I know.
It's the age when, you know, people begin to enter abusive relationships, yeah. Either that or just everything collapses. And that's how it was for me. I kind of turned inwards, definitely.
And how old were you when you got diagnosed with the...
39.
Wow!
I know.
Wow.
I know. It's a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, in between that, I mean, I'd got over that initial depression and I knew that I wouldn't go back there again. But I'd suffered periods of very poor health. You know, I'd had the kind of ME, chronic fatigue syndrome diagnoses. I'd had severe anxiety. I'd never been able to hold down a job for more than 2.5 years. So, you know, I'd done things like accumulate loads of debt because I couldn't ever look after myself financially. All of these different small elements of life cluster around you. And I spent a lot of my time reading self-help books, hoping that there would be this one technique that would like fix me and I'd be able to cope with life in the way that other people could, you know. And I was always academically successful, so there was always that gap for me. Like, why can't I behave in everyday life like I could at school in an exam? Like, exams are the perfect environment for me, you know? They're quiet, they're contained. Yeah. And real life is very chaotic. Yeah. And so, yeah, it was not until I was 39 that I had that penny drop moment. I don't know if that translates very well, but
yeah,
that moment when everything clicked. And that understanding changes everything.
I just understand. Knowing. But when you got this diagnosed and you're like, oh, wow, I got answers now. Yeah. Everything falls to pieces. Did you go into like feeling resentful that you didn't get this before? Or was it like, you know, an acceptance? Have you, you know, of course, there's a kind of grief or like just accepting and going through all these emotions. But did you get stuck in the resentment, you know?
Do you know what? I didn't actually. Oh, and in fact, I identified myself and then went and sought a diagnosis to confirm. But I mean, I knew more than the diagnosing psychiatrist because I'd done my research and mine was much more up to date than his. And so I was having to pick him up on some areas where he was like 20 years out of date. You know?
I love this. I'm like, you know, sitting smiling here because I'm getting so... Okay, of course, it's kind of sad, but but you're like smiling with your whole face and you're like, yeah, he wasn't, you know, good enough at his job. So I did the job for him. It's like,
I mean, goodness me, isn't that true of so much in life? Yeah. But I mean, I wrote my previous book about this and I talked about the kind of the thing that he said after he said, yeah, I agree that you're autistic. You know, and he said, as you know, and he said, it's so funny because every other diagnosis I give is devastating for people. Autism for adults, everyone's happy. Mm. And it is, it's that sense of relief. And you know, afterwards you do go through, you go through a kind of grief. And the reason it's like grief is not necessarily that you're sad about it. It's that sense of unreality. Like when you've lost someone and you wake up every morning and you think, oh, I've just learned all over again that they're not here. You know, like that kind of reality that you have to keep accepting it's not steady, it's not stable. That's the way that it's like a grief, because every morning you come to terms with this permanence. Like, I'd thought I could fix myself, and I now knew that I couldn't, or not in the way that I thought. And so then you have to learn to adapt. And the adaptation becomes the thing that you sink or swim at, ultimately. And I think I've adapted really well. I think that's why I'm grinning at you now as I talk about it. Yeah. Because actually I've changed the way I live my life to finally accommodate what I needed.
Yeah.
And I never knew what I needed before. Isn't that crazy?
That's so interesting, because in my job, I meet a lot of really smart people because I meet this leader in, and they want to develop. So they are like high achievers, and they have ambitions. And I would say most of the time they are more clever than I am. Like, they're really, but there they are. I'm kind of more wise and than smart.
Emotional, you know? Intelligence.
Yeah, that's my core. Yeah. So, but the thing is, when I ask them, like, what do you need? What is your, and they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, what's your need? Like, in your role as a leader, or in your life, or in your marriage, or whatever, people don't stop and like reflect on those things. It's not, you know, rocket science. It's real common sense, but we don't take time for us, and they don't teach us this in early age. We don't get the tools.
Yeah, a toolkit. And I think it's more true for autistic kids than it is for neurotypical kids. But I think for everybody, you learn to suppress your intuition, actually. And you learn that your intuition is a dangerous thing, because your intuition says, this is too much. I'm exhausted. I'm stressed. I'm overwhelmed. I don't like being in a room with this person. This person's giving me the creeps. You know, all of those intuitions that becoming an adult is learning to squash those down so that you can do the stuff you're supposed to do. And I went through a process, and I think it would help everyone to go through this, of like opening up those intuitions again and saying, oh, hang on. I don't want people to hug me when I meet them in the street. That makes me intensely uncomfortable. Oh, I'm going to have to start telling people that. And I'm going to have to start reversing relationships of 20 years and saying, when we next meet, would you mind? We don't. And that's a whole process to go through.
that's like kind of 10 episodes just about the relationship
we
and
can
what
talk
people.
About some of those things. Yeah.
Kompisar, ni vet att mitt nörderi är självledarskap. Alltså, oavsett vad vi gör, om vi leder andra människor eller vad vi håller på med, så har vi oss själva som vår största tillgång eller ibland vårt största hinder. Ibland är det lätt att tänka att jag hamnar i konflikt beroende på hur mycket puckon jag träffar. Men sanningen är att ibland är det vi själva som är puckot. Så att få förståelse för sig själv, sina reaktioner och sina handlingar är välinvesterad tid. Så att de av er som, precis som jag, är nördigt intresserade av självledarskap, så har jag ju utvecklat en digital kurs där jag har samlat mina bästa metoder och tekniker. Och vill du gå den här kursen, så hittar du den på mtutbildning.se. Och använder du koden sårbar och superstark, så får du 200 kronor rabatt. Hoppas att du vill gå den kursen med mig. I went to a seminar a couple of years ago about autism on the spectra, and I was learning, and that I would never forget this. And there was this woman, and she was explaining, like, when a person, and now you have to correct me if this is my, you know, memory.
Yeah.
And she said, like, imagine when you come into a room that everything is like equally important. You see everything, you know, the electricity dots, you see how many lights, you see how many, and if there's something wrong with the window. And for me, it's like I can divide things from what's important, what's not important. That's a person. I'm going to look at the person first. And that's not necessary for me to know how many what's it called? This, when you put in this
plugs.
Yes. Yeah. Mm. And that was like, I'm like, oh, of course it's like overwhelming. Yeah. And also I heard this, there was a tape where a man was saying that he, like, when he looked at the lamp, he could see that it's blinking. Uh-huh. We don't see it because it goes so fast.
That one's blinking above our heads.
Okay. Yeah. Do you want me to close this one?
No, I'm fine. I mean, I get so used to it. If this were my room, I wouldn't have any lights on. Because actually, all electric things either blink or make a noise. Like my microwave at home makes a noise that no one else can hear.
Exactly.
I can hear it really strongly. When someone has an overhead projector, you know, projecting on a screen, I can see the beam of light splitting into the primary colours all the time.
Wow.
it's the level of your sensory sensitivity is so high. And it's a bit like if I turned up one of the dials on your recording device there and everything would distort as it went through the microphone then, because there would be this blast of input going in and it would go, shh. That's how most of life sounds to me. It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is. It's really mind-blowing. And also, he said on this record that, and it was so interesting because it was a clever person that interviewed him, because he was telling that he see all this and sometimes he's so tired. Of course, when you have so much tiring. Of course, tiring. And then he had like something with his stomach. He got this.
We will have
And so he went to the, and it was like cramping, and he had some kind of disease. And he went to this doctor, and the doctor asked him, like, on a scale from 1 to 10, how painful is this in your stomach? If you compare it till how stressful it is to see all this light. And then he said, like, this pain in the stomach, and that was a real, you know, problem. Mm. That was kind of a 5, 6, but the lighting thing was kind of a 9 out of 10. And that was, like, for me, wow.
Yeah, and in fact, that has really interesting knock-on effects for autistic people, because it means that when we present to doctors, we are so used to suppressing our pain and discomfort that we find it really hard to transmit when we're in distress. And there's been some studies that show that autistic people get much lower levels of medication than particularly pain medication than neurotypical people, even though we're probably feeling the pain more intensely because we're so attuned.
Of course you are,
but we don't transmit it because I'm so used to dampening down everything and not flinching at every noise and deliberately kind of evening out my affects, you know. When I go to the doctor and say, I think I'm really sick, they're like, you seem fine.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because you're so used to like survive and then you have to be more strong than the most of us.
Can't do the kind of level of emoting that would convince a doctor, you know. And that's been really hard with mental health, because actually I had loads of mental health crises, you know, all through my 20s and 30s. And it's invisible to doctors because as far as they're concerned, I look really on a level. And it was particularly hard when I had postnatal depression. The midwife got out the questionnaire that she was supposed to tick off all the little boxes, and she hovered it over the table and said, I don't think we even need to do this, you seem fine, and put it back in her bag. And I had this moment of like, oh my God. you know, the road was closed before I could even begin to talk about it, because my affect was not what she was expecting. It's really depressing.
Yeah, it is depressing. And now I have like a question, or more, not just a question, because I think I know the answer and maybe I'm like wrong, but I got the feeling that you don't have self-pity a lot.
No, you don't.
You're like, I can feel it.
I find it really uninteresting.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the point?
Yeah, but I think that's kind of the problem when you're talking to like the doctors, because they believe you when you're like feeling sorry for yourself, because they don't listen to what you say. They are like,
so true.
Yeah,
I'm so, kind of fine.
Yeah, you are like, this is it.
But you know what? When I, that lack of self-pity emerges from that first bout of depression when I was 17. I had that true rock bottom moment when I, you know, because being autistic, when I'm very distressed, I lose my ability to talk, you know, that all disappears. I'd not said anything to anyone for ages. I was wheeled to a psychiatrist where I just sat in silence and she took notes and kind of huffed because she was annoyed with me and then never called me back again. And I, you know, it was a summer and I was sitting in the garden and I couldn't talk and I couldn't move and I couldn't do anything. And I felt like I was, like I imagined myself as in at the bottom of a hole, you know, and I was sitting there. And I had this thought that like, okay, well, this is live or die now. Like I hadn't eaten for a long time. I'd stopped just functioning as a person. And I had this moment of clarity that said, I must have a survival instinct because I'm still here. And I haven't felt much self-pity since.
Because I'm like, I got this sense that, you know, you don't have it.
No. And I mean, I can remember what it was like to have it. And it's not worth having, is it?
No.
It's not worth it. It really isn't.
It's not worth it. It isn't.
That doesn't mean to say I don't get sad, but I don't feel victimized by it.
Exactly. Mm. I think that's important to see. Mm. Sadness is more like pure and just stands in like something was important to me. And, you know, maybe it's gone or it's not going to happen or a lost or whatever it is. But that's more pure than
it's
self-pity.
Pure emotion.
It's like you're putting yourself down and you're like, just thinking and thinking and thinking.
Yeah, well, that's, self-pity is a narrative. You know, it's a story that you tell yourself. And if you repeat the story long enough, you will you will learn it like a script, you know?
I couldn't have said it better, not even in Swedish, I promise you. And this is kind of my core.
This is your
talking.
Thing.
Yeah, this is my thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I really like this. Of course, we have to talk about your book because a lot of people, I think also this is like, it's published when we are in the middle of a pandemic. I think a lot of people that, you know, got this like help and belief and comfort and everything that they are feeling when they are reading. Maybe if the world was like spinning as it usually did, wouldn't have taken the time to actually read the book.
Yeah. You know, we had really interesting conversations with my publisher about this at the beginning because I think the book was out in the UK for like 3 or 4 weeks before we got locked down for that first time. So there was this brief period of time when we were talking about the book as something else. And then it became a pandemic book. And looking back, I still believe that actually that it would have found readers because actually we are always wintering in some different way. But those people were invisible to the media quite often before the pandemic. And since we've had the pandemic, everyone's there at once. It's become unavoidable to notice those, you know, those fallow periods when people are kind of cast out of life. And it's allowed us to have that conversation. And so it would have been much harder to convince, you know, magazines to talk about it. And now it's easy. Now they're like, oh, yeah, we need this too. And it, you can see the light going on in people's eyes. But there were always people there that were waiting for that discussion of who they were and where they are.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that we're having it now.
I have, you know, in my educations and coaching, I'm talking a lot about the importance of reflection. I teach it, do it on a daily basis, just reflect on a couple of questions. And I prefer, I recommend that we write down the answers by hand because we spending so much time.
It's organic.
Yeah, it's organic. And also it's different from the things that we are doing when we're sitting in front of the computer. And before the pandemic, I had to like explain why this is working and you know this is the core of every self-leadership and kind of people were like I hear you but do I have to do it I don't have time and everything and then when the pandemic hit I got like you know emails like you were talking about a reflection how do I do it because they're like forced to They didn't ask for it, but there they were at home and everything just got over them.
And they needed that vent.
Yeah.
Before I had my son, I used to work with teachers to help them to reflect on their practice and to develop more creative learning techniques. And the thing I learned, I'd be really interested to hear what you think about this and whether this is your experience, was that the idea of reflection and evaluation was a really dangerous idea to them quite often, because it had so often been used punitively within their work. You know, like if you are being evaluated, it's something that's happening to you, and it's often something that's quite scary and which is going to come with a level of criticism, whatever that is. And it, you know, will determine whether you live or die in the company. And so when I was working with these teachers to say, let's do some evaluation, let's do some reflection on how this is going, you'd see their body language immediately kind of clam up because of that terror of reflection. And what have we done to reflection to make it so bad? It's such a sad state of affairs that we haven't learned that reflection is this necessary, fundamental flow through life that corrects our course every day rather than being this big menacing bogeyman.
Exactly. And it's also, if we want to develop, we have to, like, we cannot believe everything that we are thinking, because sometimes we don't want to see the truth as it is.
Yes,
and sometimes we just listen to this, you know, strong inner criticism person that's kind of living there, and everything is like mixed up. But the interesting thing is, I was just sitting nodding when you were saying this, because it's like, you know, you have a distance, you have a fear, and you know, and my first question, I teach four questions that you're gonna write down the answer to every night. And the first one is, what wasn't so good today, and what did you learn from it? And I tell
Such
them, but
a
you
necessary
are,
question.
It is, because you are thinking about it. But if you're just like saying in your head, oh, I should have been more prepared. Why was I doing that? I'm so stupid. That doesn't lead to development. So just take it out of your head and analyze it and see, like, okay, I didn't prepare well enough. Yeah. Learnings from this, blah, blah, blah. You don't have to be a judge about it. Mm. You don't have to, like, what do you say? You know,
it's not moral. That's the thing.
Yeah,
it's not a moral failing.
It just is. Yes. You don't have to think anything about it. And
it's
also
neutral. It's an observation. It's
exactly.
Like,
exactly,
this is what went wrong. Like, that's something we can just step back and say, okay, that's an object. Like, let's take a look at that.
Yeah. And that's really important. And also, just to look at it, okay. And also, I say to them, when you like answering the question, if you're like, what wasn't so good today? If nothing comes up, celebrate.
Double thumbs up.
You know, everything's going to be, you know, shit tomorrow. Yeah. So just be glad for today.
Don't you worry, it'll come back again.
Yeah, it will. And the next question is, what was good today, or maybe what are you proud of? And people have problems with that one as well.
They can't say a single positive thing about themselves, yeah.
And that's so bad, because if you cannot validate yourself, you're going to seek it from others, and often in the wrong way.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, again, we need a whole series on this. That kind of black hole that lives in everybody's gut that kind of opens up at different things. And whenever there is challenging behavior from people, whether it's self-destructive behavior or whether it's very needy behavior or whatever that is, it's all a conversation or a lack of conversation with that great big void that we all carry that we're terrified of.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Jag är så taggad. Äntligen får jag liksom åka ut i landet och träffa er på riktigt. Jag är ute och föreläser i vår och jag besöker Göteborg 1 mars. Gävle 8 mars. Umeå 4 april. Stockholm 5 april. Och avslutas med Sundsvall den 28 april. Så man kan säga att jag har en föreläsningsturné som börjar den 1 mars och slutar den 28 april. Och jag har fått fler frågor så här, kommer du inte till Malmö och kommer du inte dit? Självklart kommer jag besöka fler städer till hösten, men i vår är det de här städerna vi kan träffas i. Och biljetter hittar ni på ticketmaster.se. Föreläsningen heter Sårbar och superstark. This wintering book.
Yes.
So tell us, because I just want to say first I ask you a question, then I'm answering it myself. It's like you are writing it as at the same time that you are experience the things. And normally I would say when people email me and like, I want to write a book because I'm going through, I normally say that's not a good idea because you're like in the middle of it.
Yeah.
But with you, that's really good. I think it's like this extra sense in the book is just, we are there with you when it's kind of happening. It feels
yes,
like it.
That's so interesting because my catchphrase as a writing coach is I always say, don't write from the arc. Like if you're in the middle of it, don't write it. And in fact, I'd pitched Wintering and the book was, you know, agreed to be published before all that stuff happened. And so actually, I thought I was going to write Wintering. Oh, sorry, I have to say it in Swedish now. Irv of Wintering.
Yeah!
sorry, I'm so used to saying Wintering. And I'm learning the Swedish pronunciation. But I thought I was going to write it from like the high ground, looking back over these times in my life and, you know, being really wise and kind of like from this settled place. And first of all, I signed the contract just before the summer, so I couldn't start writing because it was too hot and I couldn't get my head into it. And I thought, fine, I'm going to leave it till September. And then that's when the book opens because then my husband got sick and then I got sick and then my son had to be pulled out of school. And this whole crisis unfolded and it got to like December and I thought, oh, I've got to hand a book in at the beginning of February. What the hell am I going to do? And so first of all, I started writing it as I'd planned to. And then I really quickly realized that I needed to get in the stuff that was actually happening. And that was like a shame-shedding moment for me because I felt ashamed that I was wintering again, even though I was writing a book about wintering. Like it felt like a failure. And in retrospect, I'm really glad that I could track. I think it's about the minutiae of those feelings, actually, that maybe I would have forgotten if I wasn't writing as it went along. It's all those tiny little nasty, dark moments that are actually really fleeting when you put them into context, but they feel eternal at the time. And I'm really glad that I captured those under glass almost. And I think that's one of the reasons why the book feels quite companionable, because I think it highlights things that are otherwise forgotten and quite invisible.
And there's something really beautiful about this bravery that you are showing in kind of being so vulnerable, because it's different about vulnerability if something happens to us and we are like victims of, you know, pandemic or whatever.
Yeah.
But this vulnerability that we are kind of brave enough, even how scary it is, what are they gonna think? You know, it's when you're like so open. So it's kind of really admirable. Can you say that?
Admirable.
Admirable. Yeah. I felt like this is wrong. Yeah. Admirable.
I had to think about it. Like, that is the right word, but for some reason it's not landing.
I don't know. I'm like, you know, thinking in Swedish and trying to translate.
Incredible. Yeah. Do not apologize. It's immaculate, honestly.
Thank you.
And given that I'm still struggling with the title of my own book.
Yeah, but that's okay. But it's like you feel when you understand where you come from, your story, and also this, like, you already had a contract. Yeah. You were supposed to write about this where you're kind of an expert in a field, and then life happens,
as it tends to do.
Yeah. And I think it's also, you're kind of always true to yourself. So you have to do it.
Yeah, and I think we often feel like we haven't got choices in life. And at those moments, vulnerability is often one of the options you've got. And in fact, it's a forked path, because either you choose to kind of harden off and not allow those feelings to affect you, or you veer towards vulnerability at that point. And I always think that's the most valuable thing to do. And I think that's particularly true for creative people. You know, you feel vulnerability come across in a piece of work. And often when I'm writing and I don't feel like it's landing, it's because I've not pushed far enough into that vulnerability. And I think that's so true of so many of the things that we do well. The stuff that comes from a vulnerable place is the stuff that we feel, like we feel it as a mirror. For great writing, for great art, for great music.
And relationships as well.
Relationships. Yeah. I mean, that's the big everyday one. You've got to push through that. It's like a wall of, like, cling film, you know? Like, you've got to break through that wrapper and into the flesh of it, the really deep beating heart of it, to get that contact with reality, that real sense of electric contact between the reader or your audience or the person you're having a relationship with and what you're actually trying to transmit, rather than the polite facade of it.
Yeah, that's so boring. Sorry, that was my opinion. That's so boring, because I think it's boring. And I think maybe because for me, it's like I got this second chance in life, and for me, I'm gonna, you know, take care of this second chance. So it's a lot of things that I don't feel I want to do or don't want to put time on, and I want to feel, you know, I want to feel people, and I want them to be real. They can be scared, but you see that they are trying their best. Yeah. That's all I need. Because, okay, back to the book.
Sorry.
So, So back to the book. You are talking about people's need to, like, wintering.
Yeah, to winter. And that means to withdraw sometimes, to retreat, to take rest, and to lay fallow for a while, to be unproductive, to be kind of almost useless in these terrible contemporary terms that we judge people, just to exist for a while. And in fact, that's a process of remaking, but that's often invisible to us. After I'd written the book, and it probably wouldn't have fitten in the book very well because it's too much of a summary metaphor, but I learned what happened to caterpillars in their chrysalises. Do you know what happens to a caterpillar?
No.
Okay. It's both gross and miraculous.
Okay. Right?
So brace yourself. So the caterpillar makes its pupa, and it turns itself into soup. It dissolves completely. So I always thought that it was like one of those Transformer toys, you know, that it's like turning from caterpillar into butterfly and the wings come. No. It becomes a liquid. It liquefies itself. And within that liquid are these cells called imaginal cells, which recluster together and grow the butterfly. So it's like a placenta and it's in utero. It's totally starting from cellular level again, but the cells already exist. And so they float around and recluster together, and then the butterflies mate. And as I say, might not have been a great wintery kind of metaphor, but it's such a perfect concept for how we remake ourselves in those time. We feel like soup for quite a long time. We don't feel like a solid person. We are floating around in that pupa.
Yeah.
And we cluster back together again. But we have to give ourselves space to do that.
Of course. I think that's one of the most important advice I give people when they are like, because when I'm coaching leaders, it doesn't matter how many people they are like in charge of or have responsible for, 70% of their leadership is actually self-leadership.
Of
because
course.
If I don't sleep well, it doesn't matter how many studies I've read and how many things I know, it's like here and now. So it's like... I don't know this English word. In Sweden, we say, I often compare self-leadership with stamina.
Yes.
Because you don't, you have to continue to exercise if you want to be strong. And if I try to translate it, it says like persevere something like...
Perseverance.
Yeah. Can you say that about self-leadership?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Just kind of keeping on, really.
Yeah. Like, you have to, it doesn't stay that way because we're like not machines. Yeah. So it's like we have to remind ourselves of this every time.
Yeah.
And also to this, because I meet mostly ambitious, high-achieved people.
Who push themselves very far.
Yeah. Often with low self-esteem as their driven force.
So
I try to, you know, give them the self-esteem. So the drive should come from lust and faith, not fears.
Desire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what I try to do. And I tell them, you know, you have to have a lot of time just like doing nothing. And people don't think...
It's not measurable.
No, it's not measurable. Yeah. And I think like... I'm going to miss out. Yes, of course. But if you always like have inputs or outputs, when are you going to do the reflection? When are you going to like land? So for me, I have so many, you know, hours of not doing anything.
Yeah.
So for me, pandemic suits quite well because I love when the weekends and I have nothing in my schedules.
Yeah.
It suits me. And people because also I'm kind of sometimes a motivational speaker and I'm quite loud and funny and everything. So people think like, that's me all the time. And I'm like, no. I can be like this when I'm working because I don't meet people when I'm free. And I'm quite almost not talk. So because that's why I take my work with great responsibility.
Yeah. You take it really seriously.
Yeah, I take it serious. Yeah. I don't take me so serious, but my
work
is. My work matters. And also I have a responsibility because, you know, a group of people ask me, can you take this group to become a team or whatever it is. So I have to be like here and now and like in a really good place.
Yeah.
Because I owe it to them. Otherwise, I should do something else.
They need you to look after them in that
moment. Yeah, of course. And I have to be like in the moment. So for me, it's a lot of time when I don't do anything.
Yeah.
And now, after the pandemic, it's easy for me to tell them this. But before, it's like they didn't believe me. Sometimes people come to me and like, Mia, what do you do? You're not stressing so much. And I'm like, you're projecting now because they are talking about themselves. And I'm like, you know, there's no problem with me. My husband sometimes says, he says to me, if people only knew how lazy you are. And I'm like, I am. But I think that's the, you know, a big key to my success.
Yeah.
I do a really good job because I don't work too much.
Yeah.
Because I want to work really good when I work.
Yeah. And I as a writer, I don't write that much. You know, like I don't write many words a day. I never write for more than 3 weeks at a time without taking a week off. I never write for more than 3 hours at a time. Like everything I do is about making sure I've got enough rest. And that's because I need to replenish. You can't keep pouring out. There's nothing left after a while. And it doesn't take long for there to be nothing left. And then you start behaving really badly because you're tired and you're angry and you're like a toddler who needs some sugar, frankly.
Exactly. You have a new book, I think.
just finished it.
Yes. Yes. It's called, I think now, The Electricity of Every Living Thing.
Ah,
that's an old one.
That's my previous one.
Ah.
So that's the book I wrote about my autism diagnosis and how I came to it. And so that really was, again, written from the arc, which I always tell people not to do. But it was about the year that I decided to walk the Southwest Coast Path in England, like right around Devon and Cornwall. And I didn't really know why I was doing it. I just knew I needed the headspace. And as I was walking, I realised I was autistic. So, yeah, that came out before wintering, 2 years before wintering. Ah. It has just come out in the United States, though, for the first time. So it's really lovely that that's now there. And it's beginning to sell in translation, which is nice, too. I've just finished the next one after wintering, too. So that's coming out next year. So, yeah.
And what's it about?
It's called Enchantment.
What does that mean?
Well, in the context of the book, it's about finding the kind of wonder in everyday life as we're so burnt out. So it's really against the background of this deep tiredness and dislocation that we're feeling at the moment, the sense that we don't feel like we've been home for a long time, and rediscovering, you know, a spiritual relationship with the world, but in an undetermined way, in a very individual kind of small way, being able to kind of re-engage with the world around us and find beauty and wonder and magic there.
I really would like to read that book, and also this one with the electricity of every living thing.
Yeah.
And also, it's like if you and I should shake hands, do you feel kind of my electricity? Can you say that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's kind of where that image comes from, that I feel like people carry an electric current. And so when I touch people, I feel it. And I feel it for hours afterwards as well. Yeah. I'd feel it on my hands, kind of burning almost. And, you know, people have good electricity and bad electricity.
Yeah,
like
that was
some
my question.
Mine. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so it's about that sense, like that's very literal to me, actually, and not at all esoteric. Like some people want to turn that into kind of an aura or a, you know, something. And I'm like, no, that's practical. That is like literally I can feel people tingling under my fingertips. Like I can feel life in things. It's, yeah.
I hope that book also translates and gets published in Sweden, because
we're gonna
think
stare at Karina
yeah
now.
Yeah, we're going to stare, because in this room my and your publisher friend Karina is sitting here, and I'm like, okay, we have to, you know. I think it's important not just for the people that can relate to it, so they like don't have to be 39 when they can do their own diagnosis and then go to the doctor and say, this is me.
Yeah, say like, this
also,
is my checklist.
Yeah, this is my checklist. But also for the people, you know, like me, that don't have that, but I have to, because I'm kind of a hugger.
Yeah.
I always ask. Yeah. I never just hug. Yeah. But I like to hug. So I'm like, are we hugging? And they're like, no. Okay, that's fine. Of course, I didn't hug in the pandemic.
No,
but
we did not hug.
No, we
listeners.
Didn't. But this kind of understand how much of a cost something
so big
is that we're just like doing without needing to do it. So we have to understand, because we have to talk about the things that...
Well, bigger than that, actually, I would say that autism has been so badly misunderstood over the years. I mean, the fact that, you know, when I was growing up, we didn't think autistic girls existed. Like it would have been seen as either vanishingly rare, or some people would have said it was only for boys. But also all of the classical documentation of autism has been about a non-autistic person looking at an autistic person and saying, this is what it looks like from the outside. So autism became a condition, and I'm using scare quotes there because I don't think it is a condition. I think it's just a neurological difference of, you know, children who couldn't make eye contact. And nobody stopped to think why we don't make eye contact. And the reason I don't make eye contact quite often is that it feels really electric to me, and I have to look away because it feels painful. And, you know, most of the behaviours that we think are autistic from the outside are stress behaviours. And they're stress behaviours that show in non-autistic people as well, when they're very overwhelmed too, exactly the same stuff. And in addition to that, it meant that girls were invisible in their autism. And I'm making broad generalizations there, because it's not just girls, and it's some boys too, because girls tended to invest all of their energy into masking their autism, which is what I do really well. Like, people don't notice I'm autistic because I learned very carefully to not look autistic. And so it meant we missed so much about the problems of autism, but it also means we missed the pleasure that autistic people take in everyday life and in small things and in sensory experience and in finding the depths of their fascination in something that they can really engage with. All of that's missing from the discussion. And that's why books like mine, I think, are really important. Like, it's got nothing to do with literary merit. It's just time we change the discussion about what autism actually is.
Yeah.
And then people understand their kids better, and they accommodate their kids better. And yeah, adult women like me read, I mean, I get a few emails a day from women who have read my book and gone, oh my God.
Yeah.
It's me.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, some people will then say, well, why would you want to wear that label? I'll tell you exactly why, because you can understand yourself. And that's like the, you know, that's a basic privilege that everyone should have.
And I would never have asked you that question, because I get it a lot as well.
Sure.
You know, why is it like you have to, you know, talk about this? Ugh. I got sober when I was 29. It's 25 years ago. And also like, oh, you're going to be defined by that. That's, you know, and of course, to
only
be honest,
by all the wrong people.
Exactly. Of course, that's the truth. Yeah. A lot of people like talking about that when they are like threatened of something.
Yeah.
Often
makes
it's like success.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit too successful, then we have to talk about that in a bad way. But the thing is, I'm like, you know, I want to take away the shame that is bad for us, that are like hindering us from living our life at the fullest.
Yeah.
Because of course there's a kind of good shame. If I'm doing something bad, I should be feeling
if I'm
shameful.
Being mean to people, I should feel ashamed.
Yeah. So we're gonna keep that one. Yeah. So some people need to like learn it.
So people need to feel a bit more shame. Yeah.
Exactly. But not on the wrong things.
Absolutely.
On like, you know, this is it. This is what my experience, and this is what I learned from it. And some of us have to be maybe first to say it, and then the others can come after.
Yeah.
And it's not like so big for them and so hard. And also, if we are talking about the things that we have experienced, they can get hope.
Yeah.
I think it's important
to
be.
I think it's really important.
I have a friend. She is a professor in leadership in Norway. I met her a couple of years ago, and I immediately fell in love. We were talking at the same seminar, and she was like really clever. And I like to be friends with smart people, because they write so boring books. So I don't have to read the books. I can like call them. That's how I do it. So I'm like, you know, she knows everything that I'm interested in. And also the first actual talk we had, first I heard her, and then I don't remember, but we were sitting in an interview. And this journalist, I had talked to her first, listened to her, but this journalist came when she had made a speech, you know, she was finished, and me and her was the keynote speaker, and this journalist came, and she was talking to us both, but she only had heard me on the stage.
Right.
She hadn't heard Linda, her name is, she's like, oh, brilliant, my friend. And this journalist like, Linda, can you tell me about your speech? And she's like, no. and the journalist like, but you know, if you were interesting, you would have been there. And you weren't there. So sass. And I like I fell. That. Yeah, I yeah. fell in love with her. Yeah. And I'm like, this is my new friend. And from that day on, we, you know, the flights were delayed and it was meant to be. And we're like, yeah, now we are like besties.
You bonded.
Yeah, we bonded. And also I attend her courses as like I take this self-leadership. And she's like, because she's a professor and I'm more a practical person. Yeah, so yeah. it's perfect.
You can show
to
how it works in real, yeah. real life.
So it's perfect.
Without the reference.
Yeah, and also I known her maybe for like five or six years, and then maybe 3 years ago I was coming to Norway to this business institute, and we were going to work together and also live in a hotel and have fun. It's a long intro, but here it's coming. And then she said to me, "Mia, I have something I have to tell you," and it's like I haven't shared it yet with many people, and I'm like, okay. And then she says to me, "I'm autistic." And I wasn't and I wasn't surprised because you know, I think
that
this
first response, the first response, like, oh, she's autistic.
Yeah, exactly, because she's like, it was no, it wasn't like embarrassing or anything. She's like, and this journalist, you know, she was really pretty, and the kind that are used to getting what they want.
Way, yeah.
So she was like continuing and continuing, and Linda was like, no, and I was like. Laughing so much inside. That's I couldn't brilliant. Do it in this moment.
I loved her as soon as she told me that.
Yeah. And that was so cool. But now also, I think kind of like you, she took care of the diagnosis herself and realized this is me, and that's then fine, went and, but also for her, a professor, you know, am I going to talk about it? A lot of people were like, you should keep it to yourself.
Oh my goodness,
what's it going to do with your career and everything? So I think it's, I'm like, I'm really proud of her. She's just owned it. Of course, we should, but
we should.
But it wasn't easy.
It's not uncomplicated, and I think it's so important to, you know, like it's really easy for me to be out and autistic because I work in a creative environment and I've been able to write about it. But I was working in academia when I got my diagnosis, and yeah, some people were weird about it. I mean, there's no sugarcoating that. And there was a male member of staff. Who used it to gossip to students that I was not up to my job, because that's what some people do. And that was about his own feelings of inadequacy. But nevertheless, it becomes like a little crowbar that they've got that can be really, really toxic. And I totally understand why people don't. But academia is full of glorious autistic women. So many.
Yeah. I want to repeat one thing that you said. I think it's important for my pod buddies, because you said it just as, you know, as it is. The man that were talking behind your back to the students, and you said so, like, but you said it so fast and we're not, you know.
Oh, sorry.
That's cool, but that's good. I just want to repeat it.
Yeah.
The reason that he was trash talking you had to do with him. I think it's important that we say it as it is.
Absolutely.
Because he was like feeling threatened, and he was trying to give himself power over you and maybe other things to like put you down.
Yeah.
And so think about that. When people are, you know, doing bad things to you, it's always about themselves.
Oh my goodness. And how inadequate they feel. And ultimately how they can't own their own vulnerability. You know, and I was a more successful writer than him, and I'm certainly a more successful writer than him now.
Yeah.
And that, and that comes from having written a book that is, I mean, the stuff that people love in Overwintering,
yes.
I will get that right one day, is stuff that only comes when you've been through what you've been through and what I've been through, which is that kind of rock bottom moment when you realize that you have to lean into your own vulnerability in order to survive. Yeah. It's not a choice anymore. And some people never learn to do that. But the sooner you can learn to do that, like, that will help you through the rest of your life, you know, and that's what wintering's about.
I think that was like the perfect, you know, stop words. I have more questions, of course, but we have to stop now. From my heart. I feel like I really met you, and I'm so grateful for that. Thank you for being so honest and generous, and also writing this book so vulnerable when you were in it. I think it was like meant to be, and I think it's going to be really important for a lot of people. So thank you for being a guest in my podcast.
What a beautiful podcast. And it is always so lovely and so rare to talk to an interviewer who talks to you and doesn't have a list of questions. Always such a thrill to make genuine human contact.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the most important thing, right?
Thank you.
Thank you.